Maybe this will be less than 38 minutes.
Could be. Could be.
Welcome to Stargazing, a Stargate-gazing podcast. I'm your host, Mary.
And I'm your other host, Kathy.
And each week we review an episode of Stargate alternating between SG-1 and Atlantis.
Hello.
Hello.
I don't know where the hell my notes are. Hang on. They are supposedly saved on my desktop, but I have a lot of files and I am not seeing it anywhere.
That's fine. Who needs notes? Let's just wing it.
I don't remember an episode well enough to wing it ever.
There. Four of the five main cast members were stuck together in a jumper.
Then they weren't anymore.
Surprisingly, they did not kill off most of the cast in the fourth episode of the series.
The end.
The end.
That's the episode.
Yep.
I have found my notes. How are you today?
I'm okay. Sleepy. It's been a long week and I still have to work tomorrow.
It has. Yuck. That sucks. It has been a long week, and it was a short week for me, but it's still been a long week.
I have to work tomorrow. Well, I volunteered to work tomorrow because having had COVID recently, I have no time off anymore. So when we go on vacation, I'm going to have to do at least part of that unpaid.
Yeah, that sucks.
So I want my overtime.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah, because I have run out of PTO.
Yuck. Yuck. Sucks.
I'm still gonna accumulate some vacation after this, but I can't pre-use it.
Yeah, makes sense.
Lame. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, and then it just felt like a long week. I don't even know why.
It did.
Just the what's the word I'm looking for? The drag that is February.
Yeah.
It's just yeah. Sorry, I don't even have anything very interesting to say about
today.
It. Yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm definitely tired.
Are you sure you want to do this now?
Yeah, because otherwise we have to do it at 5 o'clock tomorrow night again.
Fair. This is true.
And it's too much.
Yeah, sorry I couldn't do Tuesday.
That's okay. What were you doing on Tuesday?
I don't remember if I mentioned before. I work for one of the state-funded schools, and our budget has been cut by almost 25% by next year, 22% to be exact, for next year. So obviously we're trying to scrounge additional funding from the state, and so it's been a whole big thing. And on Tuesday, let me go back. A couple days before Tuesday, there was supposed to be a hearing before the Appropriations Committee, the state's Appropriation Committee, on Tuesday. So last week, I got an email from one of my coworkers asking if I could, first of all, go to that as a show of support. They were, of course, trying to get as many people to go as possible. And then he also asked me if I'd be willing to do a written testimony. And he was like, you don't have to talk or anything, but if you could just submit a written testimony, that'd be great. So I was like, sure, whatever. So I did a written testimony and I went to the hearing and sat for hours in this very boring hearing and was totally spaced out when all of a sudden I hear my name called.
Oh,
to come up and speak.
What?
And I was like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Hours of testimony. And I was, like I said, completely checked out. No one had told me that I was going to be expected to actually go up and read my written testimony. So did I have a copy of it with me? Of course not.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I ignored it and stayed seated and was like slouching down. And my coworker next to me is like, go up there. I'm like, I don't even have a copy of what I wrote. I don't know what I would say. So the union rep comes over after they've called my name and when I didn't go up and was like, why didn't you go up? I was like, no one told me I needed to say anything. I don't have a copy of it. And, you know, I told her the same thing.
Yeah.
And she said that she really loved my testimony and asked if she could get me a copy of my testimony. Would I be willing to go up and read it?
Oh my God. I said,
fine. If they're willing to call me up again, since I ignored them the first time, and since this is like a very strict, everyone has 3 minutes, they're calling people in order, then they move on, it's very ordered, and I didn't think that it would actually call me up again. But in any case, I was trying to get into my email on my phone, my work email on my phone, because I knew I had sent her a copy of it. But because I don't normally keep my work email open, it was taking a while. And I hear them call my fucking name again.
Oh, my God. Come on.
Yeah. So I'm like, all right, well, shit, what do I do? Because this is going to continue to take at least a few more minutes before I can get a copy of this. And I only have 3 minutes to speak. I can't ignore them again. And so I was like, all right, fuck it. Sorry for all the swearing, but this is such a really stressful night.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, I'm going to go be on TV and testify in front of the Senate and House Appropriations Committee without any notes. And
cool.
Hope I can remember most of what I wrote. I didn't even remember the names of the people that I was supposed to be addressing. So I was like, I'm sorry, no one told me I had to speak tonight. So I don't have anything printed out in front of me. I'm going to do the best I can. And I just address them as members of the committee. And I was told I did a very good job, but then, of course, afterwards, I was just beating myself up over all the things that I forgot to say because I was trying to not run out of the room screaming in terror.
Yeah.
It was a crazy, stressful night, and I would have rather been recording this podcast than doing that. But like I said, I was told I did a good job.
Yeah. Good. Good. I bet you did.
But that was what made this feel like such an extra long and stressful week, because that really took me a couple days to recover from.
Yeah.
I've largely gotten over my fear of public speaking, obviously, because it's what I do for a living.
Right.
But teaching a class is obviously very different from testifying in front of a bunch of committee people that are in the state Senate.
Yeah.
And also a room full of 200 people, because there were also a bunch of observers there, and also it is recorded and broadcast. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nerve-wracking.
I bet.
Yeah. And then I ran on a treadmill for 2 hours plus today, and that was also not nerve-wracking, but mentally draining, and I hated it, and that's been my week. Yeah.
Should have pulled up your stargazing notes and just read those.
I don't have those. Didn't have those with me either.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, but that would have been a good idea. I could have also just referred them to this amazing podcast that I know of.
Exactly.
And been like, you can hear all about cool things and why science and education need to be funded.
Yes.
You go to this podcast where we frequently talk about things that don't have anything to do with education, but sometimes have to do with funding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of being totally fucked unexpectedly.
What? Who?
Shepard, and also Tayla, and also Ford, and also Rodney are all pretty screwed in this episode, especially Shepard. Doubly so.
Indeed.
Also, whoever the guys were that were driving the shuttle pod puddle jumper.
Yeah.
Thing, but they weren't really in the episode.
No.
Yeah.
What's this that we're talking about? Do you want to say?
I have no idea because I actually don't have it in front of me. 38 then, minutes, is that it?
Yes, it is.
Stargate Atlantis. Yeah, okay.
Season 1, episode 4.
Fabulous. Yeah.
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 38 minutes. We should try to do this podcast in 38 minutes.
We should. Oh, I don't have the correct notes.
Oh.
Why don't you go ahead and start while I try to collect myself and find my notes?
Okay.
Thanks.
Do-do-do-do-do. There's a puddle jumper. It's flying in space. There's a planet that we can see that has some rings around it. Then we go inside the jumper where we've got a couple of pilots that we don't know who are hanging out piloting while Ford is overseeing them. He comes up and asks one of them how things are going and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he's like weirdly patting his arm.
Yeah. He was very acting. I mean, like, we see in a minute why he was acting so stressed, but he was, it almost looked like he was jonesing for a fix because of the arm padding, and he was rocking back and forth, and it was weird.
Okay, we'll just smoke a little bit.
A little bit.
Just enough to get into our system.
Yeah.
Yep. And then Ford tells him that they've got to thread the needle or they're all dead, which they are referring to getting the puddle jumper through the Stargate.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get a glimpse of the back of the puddle jumper where the rest of the Stargate Atlantis team is hanging out. Shepard's not in good shape. He's got some kind of giant bug attached to him.
Yeah, it's very gross.
Attached to his neck, just hanging out.
Mm-hmm. Essentially like a hagfish with legs and wings.
Yeah, its creepy legs are like wrapped around his neck. Ugh. He wants that thing off of him, but Taylor says they can't get it off.
Probably worth mentioning that it's also biting him and seeming to be drinking his blood.
Yeah, or something.
Like a
yeah.
giant mosquito with it's a scorpion tail.
So gross. So gross. Yeah. So he's having a medical emergency that they are planning to call Atlantis for before they even get through the gate to let him know they're going to need some help on the other side. They've apparently been trying to remove this creature.
Stabbed, shot, strangled, suffocated, and bludgeoned.
And it makes Shepard's pain worse when they try. They approach the Stargate, which has been activated, and as they are approaching, we've seen the Puddle Jumper is like this very like cylindrical, it's basically like a tin can, but yeah. it has little like things on the side that pop out that, you know, tootle it along. Is that the
yeah.
yeah. Yeah. And when they get to the Stargate, those things are supposed to go back into the tin can shaped ship so that they can fit
through.
Supposed
to retract into
yes.
the sides.
So they can fit through the Stargate. They don't. We get a flash outside, a glimpse of it, and they are not all the way in.
Oops.
Yes. But they don't know that yet. They are still forging ahead towards the gate to get through. They radio to Atlantis. They've gotten a medical emergency. Weir wants to talk to Shepard, and they're like, nope, he's the injured guy, so sorry. They report to Weir about, as Ford says, the funky alien bug attached to Shepard's neck. Shepard is completely immobile at this point. His legs are numb and his arms are numb and...
How are you disabled? Leg disabled!
They haven't been able to get it off. Dr. Weir's like, you really shouldn't be bringing this back to Atlantis, but they don't have a choice. So she is like, cool, come on in.
What if that thing could replicate readily and then started just attacking all of them?
I don't know. We don't know. It's fine. Everything's fine. Yeah. So they're like, cool, we're going to head in. And then the Puddle Jumper starts to go through the gate, but then it's stuck in the Stargate. Partway through, partway still in space. The front half is through, the back half, which contains Taylor, Ford, and Shepard.
And Rodney.
And Rodney is just, they're just there. But the guys in front, they're gone.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's just a puddle.
Yep.
The puddle is like in the middle of the ship.
Yeah. Yeah. And then credits.
Then credits. After credits, we're in the control room. Weir is obviously trying to get more information about what's happening and where the team is. They should have come through by now. So Weir asks, where are they? The technician says, I don't know. The gate's still active. Obviously, because the big gate still has the puddle event horizon in it. I don't know why he felt the need to say that. Based on when they lost communications and when the team said that they were heading into the gate, though, they should have obviously come across on the other side already. Then we're back in the Puddle Jumper. McKay realizes what happened before anybody else did. The wing things on the side, as he describes them, are called drive pods. And he figures that, as Kathy said, when they tried to retract them, they did not retract all the way, which means that the ship was too wide to actually fit through the Stargate. Either that or maybe the Stargate shrank, but he very much doubts that that is the case. And so now they've got a huge problem, because there isn't really any direct means of them retracting those things from where they are in the cargo bay. The controls for that would have been up in the front of the ship, which is now solidly in the puddle, and so if they tried to go up there, they would be dematerialized before they could get to the controls, which would also be dematerialized.
Aww.
As they're looking at the puddle, they realize that there's an arm sticking out of it, which was Ford, so they pull Ford out of there. I guess even though he was mostly dematerialized
yeah.
up to his arm, they're still able to pull him back out of it.
I was a little confused about that,
yeah.
but I'm just going to go with
Same.
It.
Yep. Yeah. So then Weir calls them and asks them what's going on, and they give her an update that there's no way they can get the two out of the cockpit because, again, they won't be able to get to them. The guys are dematerialized and their hands would dematerialize. And they tell her the situation with Major Shepard.
Shepard.
He is currently unconscious, in fact, so he is actually getting even worse than he had been before. They continue to go back and forth for a while and basically just explain all of the same things over again that I just talked about. They also reiterate the fact that all of the ship's controls are dematerialized currently, and there is literally nothing that they can do from back here, at least as of right now. Weir asks for a little bit more background on what was going on before this whole situation went down the way it did. They had gone back to the planet where they first encountered the Wraith, but apparently whatever cave or ship or building, whatever that was that they were inside before that had like the honeycomb ceiling with all the Wraith in it, that whole thing is gone. There's just a giant crater in the ground where that had been. So that seems bad. They confirm that they are, in fact, in the correct spot. The thing is just gone, whatever it was that they were in. And they don't think that it's because it was destroyed, because this giant crater is not a blast crater, they're able to determine. They think that they picked up and left. So even though they thought that it was a mountain with a cave in it, it must have been some sort of a giant spaceship or vessel or something, even though it was covered by mountain and trees previously, Ford reiterates. Shepard reminds Ford, and Rodney for that matter, that the Wraith hibernate for centuries at a time, so it is plausible that there would be trees and dirt and all kinds of stuff growing over whatever ship they were all hibernating in. And they notice some movement off in the distance, and they start getting fired upon by the Wraith. That's the end of the flashback, and we're back in the jumper.
Rodney is questioning Ford starting at the very beginning of his story, but Ford is like, no, she definitely needs to know this. Rodney's like, we're wasting time. He then explains why they have only 38 minutes to figure this problem out. He said science things about it. We already knew that there was a 38-minute limit, so this, I think, just for maybe people who were watching Atlantis and hadn't seen SG-1. Who are those people? What? Yeah. It's possible. It's fine.
It is.
Weir decides to put some nerds in a room to figure this problem out.
The people I'll be working with, what they like?
Standard nerds!
In addition to Groden Squidman, there is a person called Kavanaugh and someone called Simpson. Rodney adds that they should grab the Czech, too. The Czech whose name he can never remember.
The Czech who we've never met before, which is why we don't know his name yet. But who will be a regular character now.
Czech, please.
Yes, and he is Dr. Zelenka, as Weir reminds him. And while those folks are in a room trying to figure this out, Rodney's going to, you know, Rodney on his side of things. It doesn't have the same ring as Samming it.
It doesn't. No, it really doesn't. No. Rodneying.
Yeah.
McKay.
Yeah.
Meredithing.
Meredithing.
No, I'm just getting ahead of things.
Yes. Meanwhile, Dr. Beckett comes into the control room and is like, where is my patient? But he is obviously not there because of the problem. Yes. That's it. That was not that interesting. That was not even necessary to put that in. But here we are.
Yep. Back on the puddle jumper, Shepard wakes up and asks Tayla if she's okay because she's looking through the med kit. It was nice of him to be concerned for Tayla more so than himself at the moment, but she was looking through the med kit to see if there's anything that she could find that would help him. So he is really the only one that seems to have any kind of injuries. He is surprised that they are not back at Atlantis yet, because last thing he remembers, they were just about to head through the gate. And of course, they update him on the situation. And so he says that now his day got worse and it was already pretty bad to begin with. We get another flashback of the Wraith planet. The puddle jumper was being fired upon while they were trying to escape. And then we're back in the current puddle jumper. That was a very short and pointless flashback.
Yeah.
Okay, I could have skipped that, but whatever. They just keep repeating the same stuff over and over again. They're again talking about how the cockpit is gone and not accessible.
Yeah.
Back in the briefing room, Atlanta.
Ancient Atlanta was more than just a Delta hub. It was a vibrant metropolis, the equal of Paris or New York.
That's right, honey. Whatever you say.
Atlanta. Weir has just debriefed everyone that's going to be involved in this rescue effort, all of the room full of nerds that she had mentioned before. She described the situation to them, and they need to go and hang out in Puddle Jumper 2 to try to explore it and figure out a way that they can help Shepard and everybody who are all in Puddle Jumper 1. Kavanaugh is concerned about the lack of time, but Weir says, well, they can't admit defeat yet because there are 6 people on that ship that still need rescuing. Beckett is there and asks to be forgiven for his stupid question, but what if they just all stepped through the event horizon? Wouldn't that be fine? And long story short, this seems weird to me, but they say specifically Grodin says that the Stargate transmits matter in discrete units, basically meaning that the whole ship has to come through or none of the ship comes through at all, which was weird to me, but
so that fine. That means Kowalski's head never went to the other side.
I also immediately went to the back of Kowalski's head. Because, yes, all the way back in what, like the second episode of the podcast, second episode of SG-1, Kowalski gets the back of his head cuddled off and we talked about what happens on the planet that it comes through on. Yeah. Apparently it wouldn't have gone through. It would just have been vaporized or something.
Yep, into the ether. It's another feet shoe situation.
Yeah.
Except for instead of just feet, his whole body was left behind, except for part of his head.
Yeah. It was weird. Yeah. Anyway. So walking through the gate and waiting for the gate to shut down isn't an option, because when the gate shuts down, it's just going to vaporize everything that was dematerialized thus far. So the whole cockpit and anybody in it would just be gone. They wouldn't come through on the other side all of a sudden. They talk briefly about maybe closing off the bulkhead so that when the gate does shut down, they would at least have a few seconds or a few minutes in the cargo bay before they completely lost all pressure and air and life support. And maybe that would be just enough time to send the second jumper through, but then they would still lose the 2 guys that were in the cockpit. And also, I have no idea how they would be able to rescue anybody on the first jumper in that case. Like, can they ring them over, or how would they get them off of the first jumper onto the second jumper?
You and Kavanaugh are both wondering that.
Yeah. Also, I would imagine it would still just be there lodged in the ring. It's not like it's going to suddenly
wouldn't you just crash into it?
No, because they'd be vaporized by the puddle when the gate opens again.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
So if it's if it's lodged in the gate ring, like the puddle is set back a few inches from the front edge of the ring. So yeah, that wouldn't have worked anyway, although they don't address that fact. But So Weir tells everyone to figure it out. And then they're gonna contact the other jumper with whatever recommendation they can find.
Yeah. Back in the jumper, Rodney is busy trying to figure out the problem on his end. He's got a computer attached to the ship, and he actually gets the bulkhead door closed, which there's no light in the cabin, so he's left them in darkness.
Yep.
Because the Stargate was lighting up. Yeah, the puddle was obviously bright. Yeah, it always is. Yeah.
What is the light coming from in the puddle exactly?
I don't know.
It is always emitting light, but what exactly is producing light?
Wait, the energy the gate must release to create a stable wormhole, it's astronomical, to use exactly the right word. You can actually see the fluctuations in the event horizon.
I don't know. Maybe the remains of people dematerialized in it. I don't know why they would light up, but they might.
That must be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Powered by dead bodies. Okay.
Yep.
The light, anyway. The light energy comes from dead bodies.
Powered by dead bodies could be the name of this episode.
Yes. Fabulous. Agree.
Grodin Squidman radios to the jumper to recommend they close the bulkhead door.
Yes.
And Rodney's like, cool. Got anything else? Because did that already. But no, they're still working on it. So he cuts off contact. And Rodney's like, thanks for calling. Rodney explains why he closed the door, which we already know the reason, because they'll have some moments of time before they also die if the Stargate does close. Rodney says he prefers apoxia to explosive decompression as a way of dying.
They both sound unpleasant. I would actually think that the explosive decompression would be faster.
Yeah.
I think I'd prefer that one.
Rodney is, I think as we saw in the last episode too, is the type of person to kind of catastrophize. Even though he's...
Yes, we definitely saw that.
He's still working through things, but he's like, you know, oh my God, we're...
Complaining,
you know,
the whole time.
Yeah, about like the worst case scenarios.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, the air is going to be real thin in 27 minutes. Shepard tells him and Ford, who are kind of having a back and forth at this point, to stop. He's like, we're not giving up on the other guys who are in the...
Yes.
In the event horizon or through the event horizon. And we've got time, plenty of time to solve this thing, but shut up and start using your brain.
McKay says that he just reacts a certain way to certain doom.
Doom!
And that brought questions up for me.
Ooh.
First of all, how often is he finding himself in certain doom situations that he's actually developed any sort of a habit, because you need to be exposed to something a lot for it to become a habit.
True.
In which case, the fact that he's been exposed to that type of situation many times would mean that it was in fact not ever certain doom before. And so you would think that the situations that had seemed like certain doom that didn't end up being certain doom would have desensitized to him or taught him that there is always at least a little bit of hope, even in bad situations.
What?
But apparently not.
No. Maybe he's only been exposed to other people's certain doom, like when he thought Teal'c was just dead in the Stargate.
Maybe.
I'm going to keep bringing that one up. But then when he's talking about that, he ends it with, maybe there's a way to manually retract the mechanism. So, you know, maybe they'll work on that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Taylor is tending to Shepard. He says his pain is not so bad now, and the reason is because he is numb and can't move. And he's like, you guys need to get this off of me because I'm probably going to die even before you do, if we all are going to die.
That's bad.
Yes.
Then we're back in Puddle Jumper 2. Actually, probably in Puddle Jumper 2 for the first time. Whatever. Zelenka is there, as is Dr. Weir. She's just coming in to check on things. She doesn't want to slow them down, but is wondering if they have any kind of an update. Zelenka talks about some of the technology of the ship, but the moral of the story is that it's going to be dangerous for them to experiment the way that he's experimenting, so it's a good thing that they have this other backup ship. And they're going to need to be careful to not accidentally open the rear hatch of Puddle Jumper 1 or shut off their life support system entirely, which apparently is very easily possible if they're not careful or if Rodney starts poking stuff without knowing what it actually is. So Zelenka is going to keep working on figuring out the exact correct pathway and wiring and stuff that Rodney is going to need to futz around with so that he doesn't accidentally kill them all in trying to fix the problem. Back on the Puddle Jumper 1, I should specify, they're still trying to get the bug thing off Shepard. We get another flashback of when Shepard first got the thing attached to him and they tried to shoot it. That ended badly. They did manage to not shoot Shepard, but first of all, I would think he would have gone deaf, but we're not going to address that fact because you know, it was right in his face when Ford fired it. He didn't fire it at Shepard's face, obviously, but shot the bug right in Shepard's face and the bug just got angry and Shepard screamed in agony. Everything that they've tried to get this thing off just makes the thing either bite him harder or squeeze his neck more. And also the thing can heal itself, so it doesn't even seem any worse for wear for the fact that they've been pulling on it and poking it and stabbing it and shooting it. It's feeding on Shepard's strength, like a wraith. Taylor says she's heard stories of creatures like this from the various forest and swamp areas around their camp, and she thought that it was just an old wives' tale, essentially, to keep the kids from wandering off too far. Shepard wants to know if her dad ever said anything about how to kill it, but doesn't seem like he ever did, and they have no information about what they should do next to reasonably get this thing off of Shepard without killing him.
They decide to talk to Dr. Beckett about it through the radio. The magic of radio. Indeed. Through the magic of Stargate.
It's really convenient that radios work both ways no matter what when there's a wormhole open.
That's true. They give him a rundown of Shepard's current condition. And then Beckett says, I'm told you have something of a Klingon.
Yes. Spelled C-L-I-N-G.
Yeah.
It's quite funny.
Just in the face he makes when he says it, he like instantly knows what he just said and is like, oh God.
Yep.
Shepard's like, yeah, that's funny.
I am not a merry man.
He asks for more information about the bug and how it attached itself to Shepard. So we got another flashback of the planet where they're still trying to escape the Wraith. While they're trying to escape, Shepard manages to walk into like a big web, which is where this bug lives, apparently.
Yeah.
And that's how it ends up attaching to him. He gives Beckett a description of the thing, 2 feet long, including its tail, and that is wrapped around his armpit. 2 sharp spiny things that are in Shepard's neck, near the carotid artery. His other legs are wrapped around Shepard, blah blah blah. Hard shelf, but there's a soft underbelly. Shepard describes his symptoms. He was in a lot of pain, and now he just can't feel anything. In addition to shooting, they tried cutting it and burning it, and none of those things helped. Taylor brings up that she thinks it's related to the Wraith, the creature, because it also healed itself, as you had said before.
That really is not a good reason to just assume that 2 different creatures are related. Lots of animals have regenerative capabilities that are not at all closely related to each other. But what do I know?
Yeah, that's true. You know more than I do, so.
Lizards and starfish, for example, if anybody wants one.
Thank you, yes.
Or sea stars, I should say. They're not actually fish.
But we call them starfish.
We do. That is the common vernacular. Although I worked with somebody when I worked in aquariums who always hated it when people called them starfish.
Do they actually wear shorts?
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right.
Definitely.
Just like SpongeBob.
And they have deep voices and walk around on just 2 legs.
Hell yeah.
They're bipedal.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
No, this is Patrick.
Beckett has an idea, though. He tells them you don't cut leeches off, you pour salt on them. So he's got some idea of something to do that's not burning, stabbing, and shooting this thing.
In the briefing room, the nerds have all gathered with Weir. And are talking about all of the things that they can't do. There's a bunch of MacGuffin things where if they try this thing, it's going to kill all the people on the ship. But if they try this other thing, it could destroy the entire facility. So we can't do this thing. We can't do that thing. Weir says, well, you're supposed to work on solutions. She doesn't want to hear about all of the things that they can't do. She wants to know what they can do. But Kavanaugh doesn't seem to have any answers along those lines. Simpson says that there is a very slim chance that they could maybe overload the main drive from the back and try to control the drive pods from there, which I thought they were already trying to figure out, so I don't really know what his point was supposed to be. But also they could, again, overload it and cause explosions, so it was really just kind of a pointless conversation about all of the things that could explode if they do things wrong.
I thought the main point of the scene too is to establish that Kavanaugh's a dick.
Also,
Kavanaugh gets stickier, but
was being a dick, and he continues to be more and more of a dick. Yes, agree. So Dr. Weir, in the long run, is like, cool, well, we've got 23 minutes, so stop telling me about all the crap that we can't do and still come up with something that we actually can. Worry more about their lives and less about your own ass, she says specifically to Kavanaugh.
Weir runs into Holling. Or Holling comes to see them, along with some other Athosians. Because indeed, they want to perform some kind of death rites for Taylor in case she dies in 20 minutes.
Yikes.
Weir is not hearing this. She is like, we're not going to let Taylor prepare for death because we think we can still save them. So no. It's a lot of back and forth, but that's the conclusion. Hanling wants to do this thing that is important to his culture and his people, and Weir is like, no, too bad. And Hanling is left sad and disappointed.
Indeed.
Indeed.
He doesn't leave, though. They just go hang out nearby.
I guess she left him is more. Yeah.
Next, Beckett is talking to the people out in space again about all of the things that they have in their inventory. He wants to know everything that they have in their medical kit, everything that they have on them, like whatever knives or supplies they might have with them. So Ford goes through a list of stuff that they've got in their vests and in their first aid kit.
I'm packing you an extra pair of shoes and your angry eyes, just in case. And if you get hungry, here's some cheese puffs and a key. I don't know what it's for, but you never know. And a golf ball, if you have time for golf. And a plastic steak and a rubber ducky and a yo-yo.
And essentially, they're going to try things one at a time to see if anything works. They find a defibrillator, but Beckett says don't use that one because that would actually most likely just kill Shepard because an electric shock to the thing could well work, but you can't shock the thing without shocking Shepard, and shocking him with a defibrillator would stop his heart.
I am shocked! Shocked! Well, not that shocked.
Back in the control room with Kavanaugh and Weir again, Kavanaugh is incensed about Weir talking to him the way that she did, and he basically says that he thought that it would be so much better to work in Atlantis where the military wasn't running things, and it's not actually any better because he doesn't like her, essentially, is the moral of the story. And he thinks that she's not being nice enough to him, and she hurt his feelings in front of all his coworkers, and it was so very sad.
Yeah.
He's just essentially whining because his pride has been hurt, and he just came across like a chauvinistic garbage person was the moral of this scene, for at least as far as I am concerned.
Yeah.
And Weir is essentially like, well, we're cut off from everyone on Earth, which basically makes us like a colony. So think of me as the governor and maybe have a little bit more respect and also just go suck it up and do what I tell you to, rather than whining about wanting me to be nicer to you when you are just not doing your job. And then she also says to not waste any more time with this bullshit because he should currently be more concerned with saving the lives of the people on the ship rather than arguing with her about his pride. And she threatens him with dialing the coordinates of a very lonely planet where she can let him be as self-important as he wants to be, which I thought was pretty fantastic threat.
Yeah.
He thinks that she's kidding. She swears she is not. So he goes back to work. Kavanaugh says they'll talk about it later. Weir says they will never talk about it again. It was a pretty great scene for Weir, I think.
Yeah, it was definitely a very good Weir scene.
Establishing the fact that she's not going to take any shit from anybody, it was excellent.
Yeah. And there are worse people than Rodney on this
And there
base.
Are worse people. Yes, there are worse people than Rodney, because Kavanaugh is so much worse than Rodney, at least as of right now. I don't remember much
this
about
Rodney,
whether or not he
anyway.
Gets less insufferable, but yeah, Rodney gets... I like Rodney better here, and I remember that he continues to get a bit better throughout the series, too. So
yeah. And then Zelenka has some kind of breakthrough. He excitedly calls the control room that he might have something. The next thing we see is that they are reporting to the stranded puddle jumpiner.
Puddle jumpiner.
The puddle jumpiner.
That would also be a good title.
Yes. They're reporting that Zelenka has come up with something. And that is that he has found the control systems to retract the drive pods so that Rodney can work on that on his jumper.
Fabulous.
Yes. And Rodney is like, this is excellent news. He's like, cool, these pathways have been seen and that increases his chances, he says, of fixing from 1 in 1,000,000 to 1 in 1,000. Then he warns Dr. Weir that if he does in fact accidentally trigger an overload, he's only going to have 7 to 9 seconds to warn her. 7 to 9, not 79, sorry. Seven. It just got mooshed.
Yeah.
7 to 9 seconds to warn her to close the shield without hesitation. Dr. Weir's like, yes, we know. Just do your best. It's going to be fine.
Back down on the floor with Ford and Taylor and Shepard. They're going to start with some iodine. It does nothing. The bug does not react to iodine. McKay asks if they have any food because he's teetering on the brink of a hypoglycemic reaction, and everyone else seems so judgmental, but he has a very good point. Hypoglycemia, which I actually frequently get myself, would mean that he can actually become dizzy, he could faint, he could go into seizures, but best case scenario, a mild hypoglycemic reaction would give him brain fog and make it harder for him to focus at a time he really needs to focus. So it's actually not unreasonable that he's concerned about needing something to eat right now.
Fair.
Yeah. They try some alcohol on the thing. Shepard asks if he can have some. They talk about the fact that it's not the right type of alcohol because it's isopropyl and not ethanol, which is the type that we drink, not the isopropyl. The ethanol is what we drink.
What happens if you drink the isopropyl?
I mean, it would be pretty toxic. It wouldn't kill you necessarily, okay. I don't think, unless you drank large doses of it, but it would hurt a lot.
Ooh.
And I would imagine you would probably throw it right back up.
Okay, ew.
Would be my guess. Because, yeah, it's not a thing that we're equipped to digest. It's not even that much of a bigger molecule than the ethanol, but it's different enough that our bodies would not be happy with it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. They move on to salt. They apparently have a salt packet. They put that on the thing, and that does not do anything. It is not, in fact, a leech or a slug or whatever. Mm. It doesn't I mean, it's got a hard carapace, so I don't really know what they were expecting to happen when they're pouring things onto this insect-like creature's exoskeleton, but whatever. It didn't react to salt. They pour water on it, and the thing either hated the water or hated the combination of salt and water and started to squeeze Shepard even harder. Shepard turns really red, yeah. Which I was wondering how they got that to happen. There must, like, are they actually legitimately choking him at this point? He was so red.
Know. He was also screaming. Yeah.
Yeah. So that didn't go well.
I mean, when babies scream, their face gets real red, so.
Very
true.
Just.
Maybe he did a lot of rehearsal screaming, pre-screaming. I don't know. Anyway.
It's possible. Shepard punches Ford kind of as a reaction. Like, he just flails his arm out and hits Ford, who hits Rodney. Thankfully, Rodney doesn't actually end up destroying anything. But Rodney looked horrified for a second as he's frantically looking at all the control crystals to make sure he didn't accidentally hit anything when he got hit. Weir asks what's happening. They tell them about the reaction of the bug and the fact that things have gotten so much worse now because it's dug in more. When Rodney did hit some things, although nothing exploded, they did move a little bit. And so now, as they look down at the floor, we can see the puddle. The puddle is now peeking through
peekaboo
in the corner by the bottom of the bulkhead, which means that if things do go poorly and they lose the front of the ship, they're not going to actually have those few seconds or few minutes of air that they initially had expected to have, because the cargo bay here has been breached now by the puddle and they'll have a big hole when it shuts down.
Uh-oh.
Indeed. They update Weir on the situation and says they haven't come up with anything yet besides what they're currently working on, but there's still time not to give up yet, and Rodney needs to keep working.
Never give up, never surrender.
Essentially. And also she tells them not to start panicking because Shepard wants to say something while he still can, and she says she doesn't want to hear it because he's going to get through it. He doesn't need to pass on whatever final message that he has. Shepard says he's not so sure because if there was any hope for him, he wouldn't have let me go. Weir, of course, wants to know what he's talking about. And Shepard says, the Wraith. We get a flashback of a Wraith standing over Shepard with its gun drawn. And when it sees that Shepard has this bug thing on its neck, the Wraith just walks away and leaves him. I guess the Wraith assumed he was going to die and thought it would be funny to leave Shepard to die a slower death.
I guess.
Or whatever.
I don't know.
Or just didn't want to take Shepard back for risk of the thing leaving Shepard and attacking him?
Maybe the Wraith and these creatures have a little, like, finder's keeper's agreement.
Yeah.
So the creature caught the human, so the Wraith had to let him go.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah.
Very possible.
Ford has an idea, and that is that they should send Shepard through into the event horizon. That way he's sort of suspended so that his issues with the creature won't progress while they're still trying to get out of the situation.
Yeah, it's like when you suspend a little kid in the transporter system on a Star Trek
show. Yeah, yeah.
So that that little kid with the deadly illness doesn't die.
And if they don't make it, it doesn't matter anyway, because they would have all died. Dr. Beckett, though, is like, that's not a good idea. If the creature was that upset about some water on him, who knows how it would react to gate travel. Which, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Weir is like, so that means he can't come through at all with that thing on him? Which, I don't know, sure. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's weird.
So they've got to do something now, Taylor says. And Shepard's like, all right, kill me with that defibrillator. Beckett's like, oh yeah, you're right. That is totally a good idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you killed him, it'll let go, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah, that's a plan.
Yeah.
It's not a great plan, I think, but it's the plan they have.
Yeah, kind of the only one they've got.
Yeah. They want to essentially trick the thing into thinking that Shepard is dead, so it lets go, and then they would try to shock his heart again to revive him, but if it doesn't work, then they throw him through the Stargate, so he's suspended until this situation is resolved. Shepard's like, yeah, I'm cool with this. I want this thing off me.
Of course he's cool with it. He's the one who suggested it.
And Ford knows how to use the defibrillator. So he's...
That's good.
Yeah. So they do the thing, shock him.
It is a little concerning that while they are all standing on a rubber mat, there are metal screws attaching that rubber mat to what is presumably a metal floor.
Oh.
Which could kind of fuck with things, but let's hope not.
Yeah. It's kind of a drawn out scene, but Ford shocks Shepard. He has no pulse. They get the creature off of him. Taylor throws it. And then Ford shoots the shit out of it. And it's all a gross, oozy mess, so presumably it's dead.
Why are my drippings with goo?
Ford shocks Shepard again. He has no pulse. So Taylor picks him up and they both go through into the event horizon. And there are 7 minutes till the gate shuts down.
Even though they've narrowed down the pathways that Rodney needs to work with, he's only made it through half of the many pathways that are in that area, and he says that they're never going to make it because time is almost up. Ford tells him that they still have time and they can't give up just yet. Rodney recommends that Ford step through the event horizon because if things do go badly, that'll be a more pleasant way to die than getting blown out into space. But Ford doesn't want to leave Rodney alone with the bug thing, even though it is dead and wrapped up in the Ford's jacket now. So Rodney keeps working. Ford keeps watch over the bug. In the control room, they mention that there are 2 minutes and 20 seconds to go. Weir gives Rodney a time check. He knows the time. He's still got over 24 circuits he hasn't tried. He's working on it. She tells him not to be so methodical and to just pick one at random. But if he just is picking ones at random, won't that make it harder to remember the ones that he has done and has not done? I don't know.
We don't really know.
It's just kind of a MacGuffin system anyway. But he does actually say he'll run the risk of attempting to activate the same circuit twice, which would obviously just be a waste of time. And then he does try some combination, though, and a thing happens. And that thing is the little drive shaft thingies retracting. They're fully retracting. And that's awesome.
It is awesome.
But then they realize they're still not moving.
Stupid physics.
Right? Seriously.
Yeah. They have no momentum, so they're just sitting.
Stupid immutable laws of gravity and momentum. Yeah.
Dead in the water, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Ford tries to slam himself forward against the bulkhead, but Rodney tells him that is futile because of physics again.
Yes.
There's 1 minute to go. We get the warning from Grodin Squidman when suddenly Kavanaugh is like, blow the rear hatch, man. It'll give you some push and oomph. And Rodney's like, yeah. okay, cool. And Ford's like, I'm going to do it. And Rodney's like, no, 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 it's fine. They go back and forth about who's going to do it. And Ford then makes Rodney go through the wormhole. Then we see right before Ford blows the back hatch, whatever it is, we see that the creature did not die from the many, many gunshots.
Well, they did say it regenerates itself.
That's true. But fortunately, it doesn't matter because Ford blows the hatch and it gets sucked into space. Ford does not because he's holding on. And then the jumper comes through. Woo!
Yay! Ford definitely would not have just been able to hold on as he did here. That force would have been way too high for that. Unless he just has, like, the world's most amazing grip strength, but...
Maybe?
I kind of doubt that.
Yeah. I think about trying to hang at the parkour gym from, like, the edge of your fingertips.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, it's really not that easy. And even when you have a full grip on the thing, yeah, like he does here, our hands are... Those are some of the smallest muscles in our body that are in our hands.
Yeah.
So even if you have really good grip strength, that's still not very strong. Mm-hmm. Anyway, in the gate room, everyone cheers. The Athosians are there. They're celebrating. They come and check Shepard out, and they shock him a couple times. He gets a pulse, and they've got oxygen on him. They say he's going to be fine, which it seems a little early to me to say that he's going to be fine because they don't know what toxins that bug might have pumped into him or how much blood he lost or anything yet. But whatever, he's going to be fine.
They're optimists here, yeah, in Atlantis.
Yeah.
Except Rodney
Very
and Kavanaugh.
True. Yeah. Then we're in the infirmary. Everybody is standing around Shepard, who's feeling pretty good. He says he's pretty hungry. He definitely checks out the rack of the nurse standing next to him very obviously and looks back up at her to make it obvious that he was checking out her rack. Taylor, I noticed, was wearing a very cool rainbowy shirt. So I don't know if that was intentional pride here or not, but I thought it was a great shirt. And then also Weir is wearing a shiny jacket and shiny pants that were also very great. So
I missed all of that.
Clothes.
God. What was I doing?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah. So they're going to get Shepard some food and then let him rest. Weir pauses to ask Shepard what he was going to say when she cut him off when he thought he was about to die. And he says that, yeah, I was just going to say, take care of each other. Yeah, totally. That's it. Weir doesn't believe him, but doesn't press the issue.
There is another sky.
And Shepard, thanks, Rodney. And then everyone says goodnight and leaves Shepard there alone, presumably to eventually eat his dinner when he gets it. And that's the episode.
It is the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Woo.
Did you like the episode?
I did like the episode. I'm not sure how much it came through because we skipped a lot of, like, the dialogue.
We did. There was a lot of technical talk and a lot of repetitive stuff that we did skip over.
But I think that the dialogue that did exist that we didn't talk about helped with the tension building of the situation and also between the characters. So even though we didn't talk about it very much because it was very repetitive and you don't need to hear us say the same thing over and over again because we don't have that tension building
exactly
happening. I enjoyed it quite a lot. And even though it was obvious that they weren't going to kill off 80% of their main cast in the fourth episode, it was still very suspenseful.
Fair.
Which I thought was pretty good considering they were in, like, basically more or less the same tiny little box for the whole episode.
Yeah.
They made good use of it.
They did.
Yeah. How about you?
I did like the episode a lot, despite what I may have said about it. Oh, this is so redundant. Like, it didn't actually feel so redundant when I was watching it. So I was actually kind of surprised to see, as we were going through the notes here, how often they were actually repeating things they'd already said. But like you said, it kind of went to just further establish character personalities and character knowledge, because every scene where they were repeating the same information still felt like a very different scene based on how the people that were delivering and receiving the information were reacting. So it was a really interesting episode. And as you said, it did feel high stakes and pretty suspenseful. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
And it was nice to see Rodney being somewhat heroic again, even if he was once again complaining about it the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's turning into a good character, neurotic as he may be. Yeah. I am enjoying him a lot in this show.
A real action hero.
Indeed. Flawed, but still heroic.
Yes. Yeah. So what's next?
Next is Stargate SG-1 Season 8, Episode 5, Icon. SG-1's sudden appearance sparks a civil war on the planet of Tegelus, whose inhabitants were unaware of the Stargate's true nature. Intent on easing the situation, Jackson stays behind as the team returns to Earth, but finds himself pitted against a tyrannical religious leader with no tolerance for those who don't share his beliefs.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I think I remember some of this episode.
Meanwhile, on the TVDB, we get a much more vague description. Daniel is stranded on another planet after the team's arrival on an alien world sparks a violent civil war.
That is really vague.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, I watched half of this episode on my very long treadmill slog today and found it so boring that I had to change to something else because I'm like, I can't handle being on this boring ass treadmill and also watching this boring ass episode. I need something more interesting.
Oh no.
I mean, it's very Daniel centric, so what do you expect?
Yeah, fair.
I also had to turn on the subtitles because he was mumbling so much. I mean, granted, he was injured for part of it, but spoiler again, but he was just mumbling so much that I couldn't understand anything he was saying over the sound of my old loud treadmill. So,
oh, Daniel.
Yeah. But maybe it'll get better, or maybe my opinions will be different when I'm not in a grumpy mood because I've already been on a treadmill for an hour and 45 minutes, which is how long I'd been on it when I started watching the episode. So
yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do we do now?
Anything else? I think we just need to say our names and the end, and that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to Stargazing with Kathy and Mary. This podcast is completely listener-supported, and we couldn't do it without you. Show your support by telling everyone you know about how awesome this show is. Your reviews help a lot, especially on Apple Podcasts. You can find us at stargazing.space, reach out to us via email at stargazing@gmail.com, find us on social media at Stargazing on Instagram, stargazing@mastodon.world. Get some merch at tinyurl.com/stargazing. And finally, show your financial support by joining us over at patreon.com/stargazing. Thank you for traveling through the gate with us. We'll catch you next time on Stargazing with Kathy and Mary.
I'm Kathy.
I'm Mary.
And you've been listening to Stargazing. The end.
The end.
Ooh. Yeah. I'm so sleepy.
Indeed.